listening to The Limitless, the podcast between Jason Horsley, and this week I'm talking to Jeff Gentry. It was a follow-up the day after Jeff attended a impromptu live event that Dave O'Shana gave and the after party at the Embodiment Conference. I'll have to do it on my own. I guess it's true. You gotta find your own way. How are you feeling?
Pretty good. Yeah.
Well rested. It was about, let's see, like 12 o'clock, it was a little after midnight when we got done last night here, and then it took me about an hour or so to kind of wind down and fall asleep, but I slept well. I had good dreams, which is pretty rare for me. I usually have violent nightmarish dreams when I remember them a lot of times. Yeah, lately. Huh. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's an opener right there, I guess, but something that hasn't come up
lately. Yeah.
but not last night.
No.
I had good dreams too. Is that a lighthouse behind you? What is it?
Yeah, it's
surrounded by waves. It's a photo.
Yeah, and there's a guy. There's a little guy in the doorway. Here, let me see. It's an actual photograph. There's a guy right there.
Yeah, and he just synced with the reflection. My own face appeared in that doorway when you did that because it's reflected.
Oh, trippy!
Like how waves are singing. The lighthouse itself is interesting symbolism that was in the Jonathan Lethem novel, but the wave, of course, I associate with you.
Yeah, when I first saw that photograph, I thought it was a painting. It just seemed almost unbelievable that could be real, but I guess it was taken from a helicopter or something, and the guy was just kind of stuck on that lighthouse, like they couldn't. I'm not sure what the rest of the story is.
Well, did he make it out? Yeah,
I'm sure he made it out okay eventually.
Right, but he's not a family member or anything like that.
Yeah. No.
There's Uncle Bob.
I have an Uncle Bob. Yeah. And he's a sailor. That's not him.
Anyway, so you were saying good night's sleep. I had a good night's sleep too.
Yeah.
Do you attribute that to the event?
Yeah. I mean, on some level I do. Sorry, there's a cat freaking out right now. But I mean, like I said, it took me a little bit to unwind, like after the little meeting that we had afterwards. And then I was going over the little exchange I had with Dave in my head and kind of, tripping about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then once I fell asleep, it was good. And I slept solid and woke up feeling good. So I usually wake up pretty, pretty happy. It's not like I wake up depressed or anything like that. So, but it was just notable that I had a pretty active, dream life, and it was pretty good dreams filled with a lot of people that I know and care about.
Do you remember the content?
It's faded pretty quick. Since I woke up, I can't really recount specifics right now. I remember being with one friend of mine, and we were just hanging out, having a really good conversation. I can't remember what it was about. Yeah, honestly, I can't remember specifics of the dreams, but I remember noting to myself when I woke up that
we're good. Mm-hmm. Good. And, yeah. 'Cause I dreamt about being on Dave Retreat, which I used to dream about all the time. I mean, certainly after the last retreat in February for weeks, if not months. I was dreaming every night. But being with participants and with Dave, anyway, it tailed off, and I hadn't had those dreams for a few months probably, but I had a whole series of them last night. And I remember one of them in which I was lying next to Dave. He's going to make fun of me for this now when he hears this, but I think we were both naked, but it definitely wasn't sexual. And there was, and then there was a third guy, I think, between us, and I had my arm around both of them. And it was, well, I reached my arm around both of them as a kind of gesture of affection. And there was a lot of warmth in it. And I was thinking about that today. Obviously, I was thinking about the dream, but I was just thinking about how much warmth I was feeling for you on the meeting last night, just tuning into you. And also spoke to Samuel Corwins, who I think you've maybe met at one of the Liminalists yesterday for the podcast. And again, this real warmth I was feeling. And so I guess it was a male bonding dream, you could say.
I'd say that's pretty accurate for what mine was as well. At least the last one right before I woke up. I know there was lots of others, and I had vague memories of them right when I first woke up. But then, if I don't write them down or make a real effort to remember them, they fade so quick. So that was the last one I remembered. I'd say it was like a male bonding dream as well.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
And how did you feel during your probing with Dave yesterday? How was that for you?
I felt definitely a little bit uncomfortable, just because having the attention on me, and I didn't really feel like I had a lot to say, but I felt like I needed to come up with something to say.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what I got out of the actual event, I wasn't even sure yet. I felt like that kind of still needed to sink in, and Dave wanted feedback, and I wanted to be honest.
Were you planning to speak to him before you got prompted?
No, I wasn't planning to speak to him. I was planning to just lurk in the shadows.
Yeah.
You made it so that didn't happen.
I did,
but I appreciated that.
Did you feel like I was nudging you already when I messaged you? Or did you notice that I messaged you?
Yeah, I didn't notice that you messaged me, but I wasn't actually. It just popped up real quick. I was watching it on my phone, and the message popped up real quick, and it just said Jay. So I wasn't sure that you were referring to me, but I assumed that you were.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Didn't it just say Jay?
It only went to you. It didn't go to anyone else.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's what I wasn't sure how all that stuff worked. If it was
right.
So, but but maybe had an inkling, at that point. But that was still during the initial event, and I don't think I was aware of
it. No, that was the after event.
It was after?
I didn't even know you were there until...
Oh, okay.
Because you didn't have your video on, or at least you weren't visible during the event.
Okay, my mental timeline's a little out of order then. Then once you kind of took over the reins there for a little bit, then I thought that maybe I would speak to him. Yeah. And like I said, I appreciated the nudging, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have. I didn't feel like nervous about talking to him at all, just in general, like speaking in front of people and I don't know, and not really, knowing if I had much to say about it, but I had a little bit formulated in my mind that I really wasn't expecting much from the event. At least I wasn't expecting to have a great, you know, just for it to have a profound effect or anything like that in the moment at the time. It's like, this is somebody talking for an hour to a lot of people that's trying to, you know, get across something that's, you know, probably if it's real, what he's talking about, it's not going to hit me mentally, you know? So I just tried to stay open to the possibility that there is a transmission, and that if there is a transmission, that it would probably hit me bodily somehow. But he did say a couple things that resonated. It was a little bit, I was a little bit distracted by the kind of his, I don't know if he was like his whole comedy thing, you know, his joking and stuff like that, just because for me it wasn't funny, you know. It seemed like he was having a really good time, you know, but and I chuckled a couple times at him, you know, the way he was making himself laugh mm-hmm. so much, but I wasn't, I didn't think it was particularly funny. So that was a little bit just distracting in a way.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's a recurring experience for people, and it's certainly been my experience and continues to be. But yesterday I actually typed in more jokes, and when we were supposed to say what we wanted, and I realized it was this very formulaic survey, and you could just tick the boxes. I wasn't interested in that, so then I just typed in more jokes, and because he started in quite a formal way, and then he did start with the jokes, and to me, what I noticed was, he's loosening up, good. And so then I just felt, let's have more jokes. Not because I find the jokes funny. Generally, I don't. But sometimes. But there's something about actually, formal kind of jokes, that they are obviously attempts to be funny. If it's a formalized joke, not that he's formal, but you know what I mean. He gets into a routine. And they're very obviously jokes, and they're very separate, hence they're distracting. And there's something about that which I find is generally not funny. Generally, for me, humor doesn't happen when there's a formal kind of joke structure. So often I don't find Dave's jokes funny, but sometimes I do, and sometimes I find what I find funny often is, and I guess a lot of stand-ups do use shock as part of their tactics, is when he says something that's so irreverent, like the thing about gurus and they can bugger who they want. I mean, that was actually quite shocking even to me in that audience, right? And so that things like that really make me laugh. And I think the general thing is the irreverence. I really enjoy seeing Dave irreverent, and it seemed particularly helpful for him to be irreverent in that climate, because there's all that serious attention.
Right. That was, I can't remember who commented. I mean,
it was Guy, I think.
It was, my brother-in-law, like good.
Guy.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I thought that was good, what he said. And you know, partially, I think maybe I was just projecting, because sometimes if I'm uncomfortable, I'll try and use humor as kind of a, you know, deflector. And so it made me wonder if Dave was uncomfortable, you know, and that was where the jokes were coming from. And then, of course, you can't be, you know, enlightened and uncomfortable, you know. So then,
well,
I'm being sarcastic. I don't think that's true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that was you using humor then.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't spot it though.
That's very meta.
It was, yeah, because a lot of people would think that. Yeah. And there is an argument for it. But as I said, but I have seen Dave apparently uncomfortable. Who knows what somebody really is as compared to how they appear. But I've definitely seen him appear uncomfortable. Remember when he talked about sex and specifically male, female, there was a whole lecture on that, and he was going into very new areas and he did seem very uncomfortable. So there are times, but I didn't feel that yesterday. I felt, particularly considering that he was with a whole bunch of new people in a new environment, he seemed very relaxed.
Like I said, it was probably, it made me a little bit uncomfortable, so therefore I tended to project.
Well, you and a bunch of others, as we found out in the after party, and I was quite impressed by that. And first of all, I was kind of pleased that a lot of people didn't like it, which might seem a bit perverse considering how much effort I put into bringing Dave to people. I do like it when people don't get him and they find him offensive and different, whatever. I particularly like the fact that they were sharing.
To say it.
They were sharing it, and they weren't attacking. They were just being honest and open and critical, and they were there. So they got something. They just didn't quite know what they'd got and why they were getting it, or even that they were getting it. And that's really central to Dave's thing. I mean, he said that he's undercover as a spiritual teacher, right? So if people go there expecting to get a spiritual teacher, they're going to be frustrated and disappointed, right? And many of them will just turn away, but some of them who get the thing underneath will be like, well, what's going on here? Why are you so crap?
Yeah, you know what? It kind of, I had a similar feeling to the times that I've done yoga, where it's like I'm like, wow, like, why am I doing this? You know, this it doesn't seem like I'm getting much out of this, but that's like the mind trying to, you know, like, I don't know, discount or I don't know exactly how to say it. But you know, it's like a mind versus body thing, mm-hmm. you know. It was like it, that. If I could describe the, you know, the discomfort or the whatever, that it would be like similar to that. But knowing that, you know, there's something happening probably on another level as well. Mm. You know,
well. Because you said it was distracting, the jokes and that. It's an interesting question then. It's like, what is it distracting from? Like, what were you being distracted from?
I guess the part of me that was, you know, expecting some instant enlightenment or something like that, or for him to say something that just shot straight to my soul. And, you know, even though it's like, say, yeah, I wasn't expecting that, you know, part of me is probably still like hoping for that, or you know, thinking,
sure, well, why wouldn't you be?
And
maybe even your soul is longing for it. Mm-hmm. So then what about the desire to have a connection with Dave? Was that not, didn't you not bring that to the event?
I'm sure that there had to be that on some level, but at least consciously, I just felt like I was just kind of going in as an observer and kind of, you know, as an experiment,
checking out the goods.
Yeah, and I wasn't, like I said, like hoping even really to interact with him personally. But maybe if I was hoping for a connection, it would have been maybe on a non-verbal, non-personal interaction level. but I appreciated when he said that he wanted to see people, you know, see who he was talking to. I get that. So I wanted to, you know, show up and let him see my face and stuff like that. So probably part of me was longing for at least a connection in that way, where he could see who his audience is, and you know.
So do you feel that you got that by the end?
That and more. Yeah. You know, when I asked him the question that I did, I wasn't really expecting to for him to kind of like, I don't know, like flip it back toward, I wasn't expecting that much attention, and I didn't want that much attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and wasn't really, you know, prepared to. I guess that just, it felt a little weird afterwards, you know, but there was no turning back at that point.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I was struck by that. Yeah. And the phrase came to mind then and now was that he took off his kid gloves with you. Maybe. I mean, that just came to mind. Maybe he would not say that. I don't know. Maybe he didn't experience that. But he certainly challenged you directly. No, I mean, he's always challenging people, but the way he flipped it around on you, I could see he was willing to make you uncomfortable around your question about this thing. What was it again?
The vagus nerve.
Right.
Which I had recently just learned about through having an experience possibly with it. I don't know. That was, you know, not sure exactly what happened, but after learning what I did about it, it seemed to kind of fit with what he was talking about with the fascia and the, you know, being bound up and the chicken wire and all that stuff. I just kept having that kind of mental image over and over, and thinking that if the transmission was going to the body, that would be a likely antenna or a likely recipient, you know, as like, because I was thinking, well, what part of the body, the whole body, the cells, that, you know, what, like, where is exactly is this transmission aiming or hitting, you know? And so I was thinking of like kind of like that as, so that's why I just kind of threw it out there randomly. I thought, you know, maybe, you know, Dave has some, it was almost like, wouldn't say a test, but just like an experiment, you know, like it came to my mind, and so I thought I would just throw it out there and see if we had anything to say about it.
Where is it situated, this vagus nerve? Not in Las Vegas.
I'm not sure exactly where it is. I think it runs down the spine, sort of.
Oh, it's a stretchy nerve, like the sciatic nerve.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it's like has a lot to do with digestion, and then also it's you know, with the brain. I wish I could explain.
Okay, so
that.
Pretty
so
vague
on the spot.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you've already been put on the spot once, but I wasn't actually trying to put you on the spot again, but just to at least.
I just don't want to misdescribe it.
Specify it a little bit. And he mentioned your digestion afterwards, so I just bookmarked that, because I'm wondering if you wanted to throw that out there as a test, but were you also, like, you wanted to bring something? You wanted to feel like you had something to contribute?
Yeah.
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 That was my feeling, which... well, I'm not going to talk about somebody else, but somebody else there who came through me, who spoke, and that person, I felt really, they were too focused on just trying to give something or show something, so it became a bit of a performance. Not to say that you were doing that, but that desire to kind of want to have something to offer, I certainly relate to that. I'm sure many people do. What's interesting to me is that he turned it around, first of all, because he said, okay, you think you've got something to offer, well, let's see what it is, right? Instead of trying to... and also, if you were testing him, he turned that around and he tested you. But more importantly, I think he shifted the focus from this abstract thing of how much, comparing cock sizes in terms of who knows more about the vagus nerve kind of standoff there, to what about your vagus nerve? Which is what I would expect Dave to do. Like, you want to know about your vagus nerve? Okay, I'll tune into your vagus nerve and let's see what's there. So I think unconsciously, or at least based on the result, and they say that's the best way to judge what our unconscious is what are the results of what we do. You were asking for that. You were asking for a diagnosis. Because that's what you
possibly
got.
Right? Yeah, that is, yeah.
And I think you're the only person who did get a diagnosis on that thing, or at least, I mean, I'm sure everybody was getting, who spoke was getting something, because that's what Dave does. But in your case, well, number one, it was very specific to physical, the body and symptoms and things. And number two, well, it was quite severe, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, like, he seemed to be really, I don't know what phrase is coming to mind here, but like if you go to a doctor and he says, well, you better do this or that, otherwise things are not good, right? It's not the kind of thing you want to hear from a doctor, right? So the way that he talked to you was more like that, right? There's something quite serious here, no? So that to me would suggest not necessarily so much that you're a severe case, but that you were ready to hear some truth, some hard truth.
Yeah, and I didn't really take it in that personal sense either, like that I was necessarily a severe case or anything like that. Just just what you said. Yeah, it seemed like he was just kind of laying it out for me.
And for it would be for other people too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what he said to you was very specific, but in a general sense, you need to relax, otherwise you're going to run out of time. Well, it would be true for everybody there.
Yeah.
But in your case, it was very specific. So going back to the digestion, I mean, because I could feel something in the throat around once he started talking to you, and I have had symptoms like that. At certain periods in my life, this blockage in the throat is quite hellish when I've had it, getting a belch now. But I thought, when he asked you about the digestion, I thought, oh, well, we have, you and I have talked about your digestive problems, haven't we?
Yes, we have, extensively.
So I was surprised that you didn't volunteer that.
That I didn't want to hear that?
You didn't volunteer it, because he asked and you kind of deflected it.
Oh, yeah, I guess I just didn't really want to talk about myself in front of all those people at all, felt like I had, already received enough attention and I was, at that point, I was pretty ready to just.
Yeah, sure. I know it's a common experience, so maybe without getting into that, because I think everybody tends to feel that in one way or another, but do you think that might have been a case of you feeling the transmission, even that you were just feeling a lot of pressure and wanted to relieve it?
Yeah, you mean wanting the interaction to be over?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that most people would feel the kind of discomfort of, oh my God, all the attention's on me, I shouldn't be taking up all this time. I mean, I've heard that so many times. But what if, is it possible also that it was more specific, that the pressure you were feeling was the pressure of Dave's gaze, never mind all this theory of other people's minds?
Sure, it's possible. I can't really say if I, again, like, I don't know what's going on unconsciously or subconsciously, but all I know is that, you know, in the moment I just felt, you know, because it's starting to feel kind of a little bit hot, and, you know, mm-hmm. also felt like there was a bit of a, I don't know how to say it, but like a lapse in communication. Like I wasn't able to express myself the way I wanted to, and that it was almost like responding to me before I was able to get out what I was trying to say. And
Dave
that,
was
and
Dave, yeah, was Dave, responding Dave was, to yeah. things you were communicating before you were actually had communicated what you wanted to communicate.
Yeah, so like in other words, inaccurately. You know what I mean? It's not like he was responding to what I was going to say. It's like he was responding to what he thought I was going to say. But to me, it felt like it wasn't what I was.
This is an interesting area, right? So, but what I'm suggesting in my experience is that because he's lightning fast, Dave. So he was responding to what you were communicating, which was different from what you wanted to communicate. And sure, like you've got this idea, I'm going to get to this eventually, but in the meantime, you're giving off all these other tells. And so that, I mean, that's very consistent experience of people with Dave. It's very, very frustrating.
And it could be, and that would be something that I wouldn't realize, but that maybe you or somebody else that knows Dave better and has, and is not in the position of being in the spotlight would maybe see that a little more, than I would be able to.
Well, yeah, it was your first time, of course,
Yeah.
and you haven't been on retreats or seen other people
Yeah.
in that situation. So yeah, so you're still processing it, and I'm just thinking out loud here, but it seems that there's a likely tendency to conflate similar sort of symptoms, as in the heat and the discomfort, which could be social anxiety and self-consciousness, and that even manifests in similar physiological symptoms, and a different kind of pressure, which is that of the transmission.
How would I know? I mean, in the moment, it seems like it would be impossible to know the difference,
I suppose something to do with, what came out the other end. Like, what have you eaten? You've got to examine your stool afterwards, sift through it. Like, what's the result? Like, if you were in a process there, it is an interesting mashup. Whoops, you've gone.
Fine.
Oh.
It's very difficult to know what's going on. That's why I kind of felt like after, kind of letting things sink in for a day or so, I might have a
Right, I haven't
better
given you a
feeling.
breather, have I? I mean, not that I
Yeah.
was pushing for this, but I
Yeah.
thought I would suggest it right away, and then we jumped right in. But that's probably good. It's still fresh, and maybe I'm adding something to that in some sense, or hopefully amplifying what you did receive from Dave.
I think I would need to experience more in order to really start to formulate an opinion, or not even an opinion, but feel an effect if there is one to feel one noticeably at any room, to the point where I was able to kind of I don't know, like since I've known you and since I've known you to be involved with Dave and doing retreats and stuff like that, it seems like I've witnessed some sort of a transformation with you, and I trust your assessment, and so it's enough to make me, very, very curious about it, and but also still pretty skeptical, at least for my own self, as in, people change and transform no matter what. Sometimes, not all the time. So, some people could go the opposite way, or who knows. But it does seem like you've been, getting quite a bit out of it.
Well, yeah, and you've been getting quite a bit out of what I've been doing, so you have already been getting. You've already, you're.
Like which? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just to say, you're already in the field. I mean, I don't know how much to articulate because this is a podcast and all that, but my sense, and this could be wishful thinking, but I mean, for example, you kind of remind me of Dave actually now. I mean, having seen you both together, I mean, physically, you look quite alike, and there seems to be a certain quality about the people that arrive at Dave through myself, not across the board. There's women as well as men, but certainly in a number of cases, it seems to be men who are skeptical, not really spiritual seeking, very autonomous, on their own path. A number of other adjectives I could throw in there. And so there's a specific sort of skepticism which isn't just about spiritual teachers and gurus and whatnot, but like, do I need one? Why would I need one? Which I also have had and have. And yeah, maybe because of this, I mean, I would say these are the kind of people that Dave is hoping to attract in a general sense, and that and that's how he is also was and is, and so there's a certain affinity there potentially that it's sort of paradoxical, because I would say, I mean, I was thinking this morning, oh, Jeff, I wonder if Jeff will be on the February retreat, was what I was thinking, because it seems to me that you don't want to fuss around in the shallow end learning any of the moves. You just want to know where the deep end is and when the right time to jump in is, and then you'll just jump right in. That's my sense of you. So, because you're not looking for a spiritual teacher, as I wasn't. But if I'm right, you're already part of the field. I was going to say team, but I don't want to over articulate. It gets a bit, sensitive at a certain point. It's a sensitive operation, isn't it? Well, I don't know actually how to finish that, really. Just that's my sense, is that if and as you experience a kind of affinity and alignment, as you and I have experienced, as that extends to Dave, then your interest level will, the bell will ring. But it's a kind of chicken or an egg thing, because it might be that you wouldn't have that ding moment unless you showed up to a retreat, so the real full-on Dave experience, and obviously only you can decide to do that or feel that you want to. And so it's interesting talking to you, because after yesterday, because of what I was perceiving, and it wasn't just about you, it was about everything that was going on yesterday, the way that Dave was connecting and I felt connected, there was just something really moving there between everybody, even though not many people probably noticed it. But so the way I was feeling in the end about you was, well, why wouldn't you? Like, what would stop you at this point? It's just like, so it just seems so apparent. But as I say, that's so it's interesting to me where your mind is at, because I respect it and I understand it. I mean, it's, in a certain sense, I don't understand why you're skeptical, because you know me. So, but I think when you qualify it, because it's not about Dave per se, but you and Dave, then I can see, oh, sure, well, yeah, how would Jeff find a way to relate to Dave? Because, like me, you'd want to relate as equals, I would say. That's one way to kind of simplify it. But you can, that's the thing. I mean, that's how Dave is. You can't be enlightened, you can't pretend you're enlightened. But that's almost a separate thing, right? This idea of enlightenment, as I tried to express yesterday. Dave's a human being.
Well, it just makes me think that if the transmission is what it's said to be, or what it seems like it would be, then you would be a recipient and a transmitter as well. And you know, it's quite possible that, you know, that, like you said, like I would be in the field just by, you know, having interactions with you, and that it's possible that, you know, I'm able to actually receive the message, the transmission, a little more readily through your vessel or your transmitter or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the image I got earlier when you, I don't remember exactly what you were saying, but I got the image of a guy going to a fruit stall and he's just handling, you know, the grapefruit, trying to get a sense of whether they're juicy or not. I guess it was, yeah, you coming, you said you were just coming to be an observer and stay in the background, but at a certain point, well, do you want to crack open this grapefruit and suck the juice? Because otherwise you'll never know. And so you did, you know, with a little nudging, you did sample the wares. And Dave, yeah, is a very different fruit than I am. We might be on the same stall, but he is a very different flavour. But, you know, it's compatible mix, like the fruit salad. It makes a good fruit salad. Yeah, and well, because I have an interest in bringing people to what Dave's doing or what we're doing. I mean, I don't even know how to put it in language, really, but what's happening, because then that intensifies the kind of flavour that I like personally. Obviously, I already know you and I like you and I like what you bring, and so I have a personal interest in that. But I don't think that's separate from a real felt sense of what the team needs. You know, there are missing elements here. Anyway, I kind of half interrupted you, so.
No, just no thoughts are coming necessarily right now. I think you said, like, why wouldn't I want that? And, you know, it's, you know, I mean, it's true. It's like what he's offering is so attractive that it's kind of like, well, you can't afford not to, you know, type of sales pitch, almost, not to put it in those terms, but, and it's also, you know, time's running out, sort of thing, you know, is the impression I'm getting from has been
all of that. But also, like, if you're skeptical, good, but sure, you would want to find out then.
Yeah.
Once and for
exactly.
All, right?
Yeah, which was my, you know, reason for showing up and willingness to check it out more, you know, because I don't think that, you know, the last night's 1 hour free and talking to everybody would necessarily be. I would like to see him in other, you know, other formats, other settings, you know.
Well, sure, but that seems to be still in the sort of handle the fruit rather than taste it perspective, because he's seen you now and you've had the experience of being seen by Dave, and he's seen things about you possibly, I mean, this is obviously for you to determine, that possibly no one else has seen and that might require your attention. Yeah. It's an interesting thing, because I've been with Dave for, again, language, I've known Dave for 13 years, and I've been doing stuff with him been going to the retreats, let's say, because that's the main, that's the full meal experience, since 2011, so 9 years. And so where I'm at now is kind of, like I've got so much from Dave that I could say I don't really need Dave now, and he said as much a couple of retreats ago, like you are on your own now, I can't guarantee that I'll give you any more support. And that seemed fine at the time, being pushed out of the nest a little bit. It even feels good in some sense. But as long as he's still around and I know him, it's like, well, why the hell wouldn't I be checking in with this guy?
Yeah, why wouldn't you just have a friendship? Just, you know, I mean, you guys just...
Well, that's a bit complicated, I'd say. Because I'd say, well, yeah, because we're talking about identity. What is friendship if there's no identity? If one of the players, one of the bodies involved in this friendship doesn't have an identity, and one of them does, then they're going to have two very different ideas about friendship. So I've had to let go of that idea about having a friendship with Dave, which has been interesting in the last few weeks and months. Like, oh, okay, so better let that thing die and see what's left. And we're still, I'm still in that process. So what I meant wasn't that, although that's possibly part of it. As in, I've met somebody I've got this deep affinity for. Of course, I'm going to stay in touch with them. But why wouldn't I, use that resource from time to time? Regardless of whether I need it per se, I know somebody who's enlightened. Holy crap! Right? I mean, when putting aside all the nonsense and the preconceptions, and I don't particularly like using the word enlightened even, but I know somebody who's free. Actually, I dreamt about this last night. After the male bonding dream, I was talking to a woman who was crying. And I was telling her that Dave did this and Dave did that, and he did make it difficult, but here was somebody who was helping you to find freedom. And I really felt it in the dream. Like, here's somebody who can help us find freedom, real freedom.
Have you, in your experience with the entire group or people that attend retreats, have you noticed anybody else that seems to have gotten the transmission to the extent that they've become enlightened, like Dave, or,
No, definitely not. I've heard rumors of these people, but annoyingly, they all drop out if they get what they're looking for, which, I mean, whatever. I don't put too much stock in rumors in general, particularly not around that. I've seen, one particular person's coming to mind, but has transformed so much, not in the sense, not that he's become enlightened, but that he's gone from being an ordinary sort of mainstream guy who's pretty very social and jokey and not interested in any of this stuff, to a kind of not just reluctant, but almost compulsive shaman. Like, he can't help channeling these energies and acting on them. And I don't really know how to describe it because I don't want to go into too much detail. But anyway, he's been totally transformed through his time with Dave and on the retreats. And maybe this to me is more to the point, even how people transform in that particular environment, as in how they are before the retreat and then during those 7 days, actually watching people transform during the 7 days and how different they are after the retreat. Now, whether it lasts or not at that level, like it can fade somewhat, but something still remains. But just, so I would say that's more what I've observed, and in my life too, it's incremental. To be honest, I know a number of people there who are frustrated. They've been working with Dave for years and years, and they're still waiting for, but I think that I think it's the wrong framework, possibly. And one of the things I say, and I have said, with how much I feel I've transformed since I know Dave, is that I don't feel a particular need or desire to attribute it to Dave, per se. Mm-hmm. Having just said that thing about the freedom, letting, you know, two perspectives coexist here, because I think there does need to be a balancing out. Here's somebody who's attained freedom, maybe. And so, of course, they can help us find freedom just by observing them, right? We can start to get a sense of what freedom is, you know, what direction it is, what the orientation is. But they can only show us the door, you know, we have to go through it. So what was my point? Oh yeah, that I can't separate the changes that have happened in my life since I met Dave from life itself. I can't make Dave the causal factor. So it could be that something was transforming in me, and that, well, it was, and that attracted Dave. So it's not a causal thing, and it's not a credit system. It's a thing of alignment. And so I think it and this is back to this thing about jumping in the deep end. In a certain sense, it did take me an awful long time to really get what Dave was doing and really start benefiting from it. But on the other hand, I'd really been working at that my whole life. So there was an awful lot of accumulative effort that just took a while once I got the things properly lined up. I actually had all of this, you know, prior effort that could then finally land. And that, possibly that would be my sense with you, is that you've really been struggling a lot throughout your life, but not in a futile way. You've been trying to zero in on something, and your instruments have been off. And so you're attracted to me, who's been through similar experiences, but fine-tuned my instruments, you know, a little more, and so then you want to consult with me to compare, okay, this is what I see, what do you see, and then you're getting to adjust your instrumentation a bit more, getting closer to on target, and then I'm like, well, I can only, you know, I've probably shown you as much as I can show you now, here's somebody who's even more finely tuned than I am, take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not a hierarchy, it's just, you know, about skills and experience, and capability. You know, there certainly are things Dave is not, you know, he's lacking at, and the things that I have to show him, so they're probably things that you have to show him.
I'm just trying to imagine the measure of, you know, to determine how, I guess, if it's working. I don't know if that's the right word, but the only thing I can imagine is if I become more comfortable in my own skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know. I can't think of anything more desirable, I guess. But that also seems, I don't know. It's something that's been happening through my life naturally. Or, you know, through all the things I've been through, that always seems to be the end result of it. Either suffer more, or you know, go deeper inside and get relief through, you know, through letting go.
Mm-hmm. Right. Presumably,
it would be nice to speed that process along.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, presumably that one of the, this is the thing about comfort zones, isn't it? The more we learn to be comfortable in in uncomfortable zones, the more we extend our threshold, and we keep entering into increasingly uncomfortable areas so that we can learn to relax. Eventually the idea is, and yes, time is running out and things are accelerating, we can relax even when there's a full-on totalitarian clampdown and you have to wear a mask or be shuttled off to the next COVID concentration camp kind of situation and branded a Trumpite to boot, right? Shamed as well as incarcerated. But pick your situation, pick your apocalypse. But presumably, ideally, or have you not observed that as you become more comfortable in your skin and more relaxed, that opens up new challenges for you? Now, this is the surf analogy again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The more you keep looking for bigger waves.
Yeah. It's meet one challenge and the next one is, is there ready? And it's like a sliding scale. It's like the more comfortable in my skin I get, the more the more challenging things become, for sure, especially now.
Because that's the flip side of what you were focusing on, really, was what's in it for you, or what are you seeking for, or how would you tell that you're getting what you want? The flip side of that is what's our responsibility in this? What are we responsible for that we may not be assuming? What's the responsibility that we may not be assuming or that we want to assume? I'm at that turning point now, being quite emotional for some reason, with this move, which may or may not happen, and I keep having to put it in that way because that's part of the nature of it, is I don't seem to have much control over it. But anyway, this desired and intended move to Spain to start a whole new life, possibly community-based, that, I've done this sort of thing before. I've just pulled up stakes and moved continents, but I've always done it alone or with my cat. And in a certain sense, there hasn't been much at stake because, I couldn't stay where I was anymore. I'd burned all my bridges or what have you, and it was just time to move on, like the Western hero with Cat, Mad Max even. Now I'm, there's a lot more responsibility because I'm leading the way for my wife, my sister, even my niece, possibly others that I hope to recruit or involve in this. So if I'm if this is wrong or I do it wrong, there's a lot more consequences. So I could be potentially paralyzed by that or feel burdened by it, and I have noticed my shoulders have been aching a lot recently and they're all tight, which I haven't had that experience. My shoulders haven't been like that until recently, so there's probably a correlation. You're nodding a lot.
I mean, I've been feeling, a more of a pressure lately to make some sort of a move, as far as being more, more self-reliant, more, obviously it seems like coming down the pike is, that would be a good thing to do. But when I start thinking about doing that, then it starts to feel urgent, and I start to feel like I need to make a decision, and I start to feel like I need to figure out where and when and how and do it now. And that doesn't seem that productive. It almost seems like it's I guess playing into the whole just fear-based
fight, flight
narrative that's being shoved down our throat right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, certainly, because even if, especially if it is the right thing to do it, you know, to jump the gun would be the surest way to sabotage it. Besides, you know, twiddling your thumbs too long, right? Actually, being relaxed enough to be open to the prompting when it comes. Getting the surf analogy again.
Yeah, I like your surf analogies.
Of course you do.
They're customized for me.
Yeah, well, it is. It fits every situation metaphor.
It does.
But particularly this one, I mean, the big decisions, kind of life or death decisions, there are things that involve things out of one's control. I mean, the future, number one, impossible to know that. But, you know, big moves. Like for me, I mean, think, you know, I've got to pick a house in Spain. I've got to pick a property. There's millions of properties. I can't possibly look at them all. How could I, you know, if I was trying to do it systematically, Terminator style, it would take months, you know, just to try and the criteria. I can't do it that way. I have to just, and I only spent 6 days in Spain. No wonder I didn't find a property, though my sister did, amazingly, the first one she looked at. So that was kind of a template. You follow the flow, and you don't have to use your intellect to calculate and measure and decide and determine, is this the right thing? And I think, you know, I turned around this Spider-Man thing with great power comes great responsibility. That with great responsibility comes power. I think as we assume responsibility, then power, if you will, not a good word these days, but ability is given to us.
Right. Well, it's not our power. It's a power that's being, you know, that's coming through us, or being, you know, almost like being shown the way, right?
And it isn't for us, it's for others, and even beyond that, who knows, it's for life itself. And, and at that point, I can't really think about it. And I try not to, and I try to just keep it down to, well, how was this when I did this alone, you know? Because in a certain sense, leading, making decisions and whatnot, is one has to do it alone.
Right.
One can't refer outside of oneself. So anyway, I mean, the larger point was the question of responsibility. Like, what's Jeff's responsibility now? What's my responsibility? And that's a different frame for, you know, whether to be interested in what Dave's doing. That's how I see my involvement in Dave, not as what can I get from it, but what can I give and what's my responsibility.
I love how you word all your lies. I learned a lot, I'm no longer a guy. So sit tight and close your eyes. I'll get you the pony. Yeah, you win the prize. She could fake out. She could fake out. She's else. She could fake out. Time we drank whiskey too.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's profound. That kind of, you know, plays into when I was saying about, you know, just wanting to be more comfortable in my own skin. It's like, well, so then for what, you know, that's so that I can just be more comfortable, you know, like what would I do with that? You know, is maybe with that comes a responsibility, you know, if I get to be more comfortable, it seems like that would be useful to other people as well, and it would also it would get uncomfortable to be more comfortable and not do anything with it to help other people. Mm. It wouldn't be sustainable.
Right. Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing, because you're probably like me, you don't really like too much comfort. In an external sense or in a circumstantially. But comfort in one's own skin is something else, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is inseparable from being active and being engaged with living. It's not about sitting on the couch watching Netflix, right? That doesn't make you more comfortable in your own skin. It makes you able to ignore the discomfort in your skin.
Yeah, it's like more dead in a way. Like it's not a comfort that comes from that comes from life, you know, that comes from living life. It's a comfort that comes from surrendering. I mean, surrendering.
Giving up, yeah. Submitting would be the word. Yeah, it's stasis versus motion, which is interesting. It's been the theme of the podcast with the wandering mm-hmm. God thing. I think there's something about being in motion, back to surfing again, that's really where comfort is for human beings.
Yeah, no, I've been enjoying those and relating it to my own life and my own patterns, you know, a lot. It rings true, you know. You know, like my fluctuation back and forth between here in Mexico, it's like I'm never completely relaxed and never feel completely, you know, just kind of like settled in one place, and I'm drawn to that, and, you know, part of me likes that, and part of me is also a little bit not super comfortable with it. So, but I think it's that kind of being forced to stay adaptable, and my toes a little bit, I guess, you know. So
your toes?
On my toes, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's a very liminal lifestyle, back and forth like that. I wondered if it was also on the fence-ish, like you hadn't really decided where to land.
That too. Yeah.
So keeping your bets open as long as you could, or it may not even be either option, I suppose.
Right. I'm probably just indecisive, and I'm trying to make it sound like I'm, you know, being adventurous.
Yeah, holding two possibilities in mind simultaneously. It is a way to be liminal, and therefore you're not committed to any one course as yet, which would possibly make it easier to see an opening when there was one. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm wondering now what they represent, you know, what Mexico represents. I can see the US would represent your family, or more than represent. I mean, that is kind of why you're in the US, isn't it, mostly?
Yeah.
So then Mexico represents what, the opposite of that? And, you know, solitude or independence? Or...
Yeah, and probably nature as well. Not that there isn't nature here, but I just feel much more immersed in it there. And,
is it desert?
Desert, yeah.
Do you like the desert?
Yeah.
Is that your preferred kind of nature?
I like forest as well. Not so fond of jungle, but I would say, that desert is preferred, desert or forest, but mostly ocean, you know, and being as how the desert goes right up to the ocean there, it's kind of best of all worlds. If I had to live someplace though, I would rather live in the forest than live in the desert. I mean, if I was like surviving, you know.
And do you like flat land or mountains or hilly?
Well, the desert down there is pretty cool because it's flat, but there's also a huge mountain range. So you get to look out over miles of flat desert and then see these mountains off in the distance. So just as far as like what's visually pleasing to me, which I think relates to my mental workings, you know, what you see in the immediate environment. It's like that's very pleasing to me, and it seems to affect my thought patterns and my, you know, the how relaxed I am in my body and stuff like that. And there's not a lot of visual obstruction, and you can, you know, kind of just look out over the landscape for a long way and the mind.
Well, I like that. I love yeah. that, but not, you don't have to be in the desert for that.
Yeah,
I love that. I love being able to see the contours of the earth and to be able to walk those contours. I discovered that in Mexico, but southern Mexico, it's green. I don't like desert particularly. The Spanish terrain in Galicia, I'd say, is close to very much what I like, or certain parts of it anyway. Like it's mountainous, but they're low, so it's low mountains or big hills. Where you take your pick, you know. But you can walk.
Yeah.
You can walk for miles. And
yeah, it's like I love looking at it, but then once, you know, you start walking in it, it's terrible. It's like,
yeah.
Unless you're really equipped with like boots and, you know, heavy clothes, which you don't really want in the heat, it's, you know, you're just being attacked on all sides by prickly things and little critters. And so,
Well, I mean, it might seem like a slight digression, but I don't think it is, because, you know, nature, it's what we're trying to get back to, starting with our own, and then our own nature as human beings has a general, has a way of relating to nature at large, and then presumably individually we have particular terrains or climates that we respond to, and maybe even a specific place that we're trying to get back to, and we won't know it until we get there. I'm hoping that it's Europe for you and everyone I care about, but I know the odds aren't good on that, obviously, because I know hundreds of people, well, dozens anyway, but it seems as though I've decided, or something's decided for me there, that's the continent, God willing, that I'm going to end up on. And then it's kind of ironic, because initially this move was partly about going to a better climate, but the climate I'm ending up heading towards is the same as BC and England practically. So that just goes to show, you know, that I might start with certain ideas about what I want personally, but once the momentum kicks in, any of that.
Is northern Spain?
Yeah,
is that where you?
Yeah, Galicia, which is actually where the Celts went through there and colonized Galicia. So it's possible I do have ancestry there. And I've lived in northern Spain before, though more north, the Basque, Navarra. But still, you know, I feel like it's pretty familiar terrain.
Is it like farmland or?
Yeah, forest and farmland, yeah.
So similar to BC then, huh?
No, because BC is mountainous. And I mean, there are mountains in Galicia, but it's much more rolling hills. Yeah. And it's warm. It is warmer climate, but just not a lot. And there's a lot of rain there.
The coastal at all?
Well, yeah. The coast is generally not far. But, I mean, none of the places that we're looking at are on the coast. It'd be like 100 kilometers or something from the coast. Yeah, but, I mean, the whole of Galicia is on one coast, on the Atlantic, and then also the North Galicia is on the coast. It joins with Portugal, which is where the biggest waves are, apparently. I was just watching the videos. Have you seen?
Saw that spot? Yeah. Trying to think of the name of the place. It's escaping me right now, but there's the huge cliff with the kind of like structure, almost castle looking thing on it, and they looking down. It's like a big arena. You look straight down on the wave.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, I just watched a couple of YouTube videos, but it's pretty mind-boggling.
It's incredible, right? That place is terrifying. Yeah, I get a lump in my throat just watching it.
Did it give you the urge to go and tackle a big wave?
No,
you don't have that ambition.
No. It's like, to me, that's a whole different that's like I couldn't even call that surfing, at least not for you know,
suicide surfing.
It's something wholly different. Right. Yeah, I mean, I love watching it, and I love watching the ocean when the waves are big, but it's just I don't want to be anywhere. I don't want to be anywhere too near it.
You know? Seems sensible.
Yeah. So you watched a show on that place, or
no? A couple of videos on YouTube. Michelle mentioned it or heard about it. Yeah. I've had a lot of dreams about tidal waves. Quite terrifying dreams, but beautiful ones as well.
Were you actually caught in it? Like,
The dream?
Did you end up underwater? Or?
I think on occasion it's been like that, but I think mostly I've been just flying above it, so I haven't actually been in danger, but it's still been terrifying.
Right.
Just the scope of it.
Yeah, the other night I went through a YouTube thing of just watching a bunch of different like tsunamis and tidal waves and stuff like that.
Is that something that you do every now and then?
Watch disaster videos? Yeah, I do.
Of course, you've got one behind you, so.
Yeah. Just to know what to avoid, you know. I can watch the people and be like, oh man, they should have seen that coming.
Well, it seems like a suitable metaphor, I think, for what we're talking about, which is we do want to surf the big waves, but we don't want to be foolish about it. It's like finding that balance between being timid and overcautious and being just plain stupid.
But challenging ourselves just enough to be a little bit out of the comfort zone and keep
measuring it just growing. Just right, because we've got well, we've got limited time, and I don't know, you know, I mean, Dave sums it up very simply, that, you know, are we going to know ourselves before we die? Are we going to have a full experience of who we are before we die? So, I mean, I can subscribe to that. That's consistent with my own felt sense throughout my life, that I was trying to get somewhere in time to die, not necessarily. And of course, there's a literal thing of actually wanting to be in the right place and sitting on my porch gazing at a beautiful horizon. I have that literal thing as well about dying in a peaceful state. But certainly figuratively, I've always had this sense, or feels like always, that I was disconnected from something essential, from truth and life. I only had a limited amount of time to reconnect to it, because when I die, it'll be too late, and whatever is after that. So this thing of meeting the challenges that come to us in such a way that they keep coming. I mean, that's the irony, isn't it? Part of us wants to think, well, if we meet this challenge, then we can relax and kick up our feet. But it doesn't seem to work that way. Actually, the more we meet the challenges, the bigger they come. And so then it does have to become, you know, the surfer mentality, if you like, or the joy of the challenge and the pleasure and the delight of it, rather than the burden, rather than seeing challenges as burdens.
Yeah, and I think also enjoyment in preparation, you know, like doing all we can in between time, so that we feel, you know, as prepared as possible. It takes a lot of the pressure off.
Right. Yeah. Because something kicks in my experience. I mean, once we're actually on the wave, once we're actually engaged in meeting the challenge, then it becomes very instinctive.
Yeah.
And the main thing for me seems to be just, you know, try not to panic. Try not to lose my temper, because that messes things. There are certain tells that, okay, if I keep going this way, I will fall off the board and maybe get sucked under. But mostly it's just keep paying attention and keep responding. And like on this trip to Spain, I haven't talked about this, actually, I've got the video of it, but there was one day where things went wrong. And no doubt significantly, it was the day that I went off on my own, because my sister had already found her house, and so she was sorting things out in the garden of the house itself that she was going to buy in the sun. And so she and my niece were, you know, not exactly relaxing, but part relaxing and part dealing with this technical stuff. And I was more determined than ever to find a place at this point, because she had found one, and I was getting more of a sense of what I wanted, which was kind of a house nested in these hills, so it would have these beautiful views, and I could see, you know, houses like, well, maybe that one's for sale, and so on. So I started coveting in a more tangible way. And anyway, so I went off in the rental car on my own, and the first thing that happened, which in retrospect I could have seen was a warning, was I scratched up the car, because I ended up in such a tight thing that I was going through brambles. I ended up scratching the rental car, which so far they haven't charged us for it, so fingers crossed they won't. But, you know, that could be £1,000 bill or something, even just the surface scratch. So that was a pain in the butt. But right after that, I didn't, you know, give up, and I ended up going in a different route after checking in with my sister. And I ended up in a situation which was potentially absolute disastrous. I was going up, I decided to go up this country road off the main road. This is Ribera de Sacra, so it's, you know, it's a really very traditional, you know, sacred heritage area for beautiful land and houses and stuff. And I took this road up the mountain thinking, you know, well, maybe I'll find some abandoned house there that I could buy, kind of thing. It was all a bit vague, just running on hope, you know.
And no map or anything, you're just at this point just kind of
trying to visually, like, yeah. Oh, I can see there's some houses up there that might be abandoned, and maybe if I take this trail, And it was a mountain road that goes down to the River Sill, which we'd already done it. It's a pretty hair-raising road, and you've got to turn around the end of it. So I knew I didn't want to go too far down that road. So anyway, I turned off onto this mountain road, and I started going up it, but I thought, I saw somebody gardening, this Spanish woman gardening, so I thought, I'll just stop and check if it's worth going up here. So I talked to her, as a youngish woman in her 30s, dark hair, and she said, well, no, it doesn't really go anywhere, or whatever she said, it made me decide that this wasn't the right route. So I said, well, where can I turn around? And I was thinking I would just drive up and turn around. And she said, oh, you can't really turn around up there. So I looked around and I thought, well, okay, so maybe I just turn around here. Oh no, she said was just back up into the road and turn around that way. And there was no way I was going to reverse down this narrow road into a main road, probably on a curb. So her advice seemed really bad. So, but based on that, I assumed it might be just as bad to keep going. So I just figured I'll turn around here. And all there was a little area that I could back into, but it was on a steep gradient. Incline. It was like a bank, grassy bank. So anyway, so I tried to turn around, long story short, and it was so narrow, I ended up actually stuck between this bank, as a small car, and that I'd backed into, and on the front end of the car, where the woman was working the garden, was a rocky ledge of about 10 or 12 feet, just a steep drop. So basically the car ended up wedged between the grassy bank behind and this 12-foot drop in front. And I couldn't get out, I was stuck. And it all happened so quick, you know, just like you could say now, one bad decision led to another, led to a third, and then, holy shit. And as I tried to back up, I mean, the reason I got stuck was that on the left side back wheel, I hit a rock. So it wasn't just a grassy bank, because I started digging it out. But then I realized, well, there's a freaking big rock here. And not just a rock, but like bedrock, not a movable rock, right?
Yeah.
So that was behind me. And on the other side behind me, it was so wedged that the right-hand back tire was off the ground, about an inch. So it was just spinning on air. And then at the front, as I say, it was pressed against this barbed wire, and then a foot past the barbed wire was the drop, right? So I was digging, and she was helping me dig, and then she called this friend, and so that this is when I filmed it. I just filmed the situation to have a record of it. This is the situation that I've managed to get myself into. So quickly, you know.
Yeah.
I have a real deja vu. I've never been in exactly that situation, but I've had so many experiences where I made a wrong decision and I ended up in a really tight spot, and in this case, literally, and just thinking, you know, why? Why did I take this course? This time, fortunately, I wasn't panicking or lamenting. I did have some humor about it, but I did think, you know, how is this going to end up? End up destroying a rental car and owing thousands of dollars. It's not going to be good. Anyway, her friend showed up, this lady called Olga, and she was a lovely lady. She was probably 60 and very bright and vibrant. She wasn't wearing a mask. Neither of them were wearing masks, which is very rare in Spain. And she looked at the situation and she just shook her head and said, you're going to have to call the grúa, you know, the tow truck. To haul it out of here. And at that point, to me, that felt almost as bad as, I mean, it didn't seem like a solution, you know what I mean? Like waiting there for hours, paying, so embarrassing, besides everything else, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I didn't want to push it. I didn't want to say, no, we can get out of here, because I didn't know. And she, you know, she pointed out, she said, this thing in front, that bank that you're just right on the edge of, that will collapse as soon as there's any weight on it. It's not a solid structure. It's just earth and stones. And if there's any weight on it, it will collapse, and then the car would just plummet. And if I was in it, I would plummet too. So possible, you know, deadly situation even. So, you know, she laid out why it was, and the rock, there was no way to get over the rock and so on. But I didn't say anything. I didn't say, okay, let's call the guru, but I didn't say, no, we can do it. I just stood there, basically, and waited. And at a certain point, I guess after a few seconds, she kind of relented and said, well, okay, if you really want to try, then we'll try. And I said, okay, let's try. And so then I got in the car, and then she started to talk me through the situation. But then she stopped and she said, look, estás muy nervioso, you're very nervous. You speak Spanish. And I said, yeah, you better believe I'm nervous. And she said, yeah, pero tienes que calmarte, tranquilo, so you've got to calm down. Gonna get centered, relax, because otherwise, you know, it's not gonna work. So I took about 30 seconds breathing, okay. And once she saw that I was calmer and more centered, then she started to give me these very precise directions. Okay, turn the wheel all the way away, and now, and not no power, just the handbrake and the brake, and then put the foot brake, and then take the handbrake off, and now just use, okay, now let go of the brake. And then she pushed the car forward, tiny, it must have been 2 millimeters or something, and then okay, brake. And so we went back and forth like this for whatever it
delicate
was
operations
10 minutes or so. And anyway, I mean, long story short, I got out.
It's a good story.
You know, I met one of my sister's future neighbors. I introduced myself afterwards, thanked her, said she'd been my Yoda to talk me through, you know, help me to use the force. And she was very, very warm, and I told her that we was buying this property, and she knew the owner, and so it was really, felt like a really good connection was made. Getting quite emotional thinking about it, because she really was somebody that I was glad to have met, even separate from how she kind of swooped in and saved the day like that.
Yeah, that's a lot of trust right off the bat, and a very calming presence.
So I can't remember why I was telling that story. It felt like it was to illustrate something. Not going off half-cocked. But it did, you know, all's well that ends well. And generally speaking, you know, I haven't been bringing much of that energy to this operation, that I've got to find it, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Right? You're trying to use the will to make something happen. That was what got me in the situation, and it was such a perfect little symbolic. Like if that had been a dream, well, okay, you make the wrong choice, you go out the wrong path, pretty hard to back up and turn around. Hello, what's the meta narrative? Right? Yeah. The decisions really count when so much is at stake. But if you do make a mistake, just relax, trust, help will come, and you know, be more sensible next time.
Yeah, it's so easy to feel that panic starting to come up in those types of situations, especially in a foreign country, not your car, you know, just all that kind of stuff. It's like, oh my God, you know, those happen a lot.
Yeah, me too. I could write a book about them. And I've destroyed a number of cars too, you know, I really didn't want that to happen again, especially not with me in it.
But to be able to just step back a little bit and see it as a metaphor, I think is really helpful, you know.
Yeah, well, I did, I mean, most of the trip was, I was letting go and, you know, being able to stay in the flow and things, and so I didn't come that far out of it, you know, but still, I mean, this is back to this challenge thing, that the more responsibility we have, the more power we access, the greater our responsibility becomes, the more critical the small errors become. Got to be so surrendered.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think what was the unfinished thing, what theme was, this thing about meeting the challenges just right, so the wave doesn't wipe us out, but we do have a new experience of new heights and live, you know, for the next wave, so that we are learning to let go in the right time frame, that we've let go of everything in time. And this is global now. It really is. It's like it's becoming more and more essential to be able to let go, and it's more and more of a valuable commodity, if you like. I don't want to call it a commodity, but like you're saying, like if you can relax and be comfortable, there's an awful lot of people who are going to be drawn to that as their own fascia is locking up more and more. Even is being socially mandated to lock up, to lock up and lock down. You're not supposed to be relaxed in today's environment. It's practically becoming a crime to be relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah. You're endangering lives.
If you're too relaxed, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Practically a terrorist, because we're not taking it seriously enough. So.
So I think in my overall sense around this with you, and this of course is for me too, if we might be at different stages, is you know, are you ready to be activated? Like, do you feel like that possibility of just being lit up? Well, it's enlightened, isn't it? Because, I mean, my sense of you has been, and this isn't, I mean, I have this with many people I know, the ones I like, basically, that you're kind of dormant. You're waiting. It's almost like you're waiting for your orders, but they wouldn't, you'd say fuck you if you were given orders. So obviously it wouldn't be in that form, but for the call, you're waiting to be called.
Right. Feels like that sometimes, yeah.
So, I mean, how are you going to hear the call when it comes? Or are you going to hear it, and how are you going to hear it? Because it's not going to come from a human being. But human beings might signal that it's there, you know what I mean? Like the fact that they're in your face, so to speak, might indicate that there is a quieter call that's happening.
all, there's no ignoring that, you know, everything that's happened up to this point has led me to here, has, you know, led me to know you, and through you, Dave, and you know, just I'm just trying to stay open to it, and like you said, when there's, you know, a time to act or to receive whatever it is I'm supposed to receive, I hope to be open to that, you know, and realize that that's what's happening. You know, I'm not sure what to, beyond that, what to actually do, you know, besides what I am.
Reminds me when Dave was talking about missions and how everyone had to find their mission, and how difficult that was for people, including myself, frustrating, and in a certain sense counterproductive. So I'm aware of that now as well, like pressure. If pressure comes from anything but the spirit, to use a term I used to use very freely, life itself, then it's usually counterproductive, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the eternal, well, doesn't, I mean, none of these things really matter on the surface. For some reason, your father's been coming to mind the last minute or so. So maybe there's something around there. Something to resolve. Or... yeah, because it's not going to be... this is so subtle, isn't it? Like, as far as it's dangerous to talk about it or risky, because, you know, the calling isn't about, oh, come to Finland and join the retreats and, you know, join the apostolic platoon that's going to lead the way to freedom and all these kind of apocalyptic narratives that I used to invest in. It's not like that. It's not temporal or local.
Right.
Like you or any of us responding to the calling, it's going to start with what's right in front of you right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and in my mind, it wouldn't be anything like I could never respond to that sort of a call, you know. But I could respond to, I've never been to Finland before. That'd be cool to check it out. Or I've never been to Spain before, you know, I'd love to go check it out and see what, you know, see what those guys are up to and what it feels like, and, you know, just, you know, that type of thing, and go into it with that type of a mindset. Seems like it would be more productive, and or just, you know, I would be able to be open to whatever.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. It's just the price of a plane ticket. I certainly hope you do. I mean, there's a lot of people I would like to see, but maybe that's part of the thing. There's probably too many, so I wouldn't just start flying around the world to see people. And it wouldn't be a social thing either. So
right. There
has to be some extra impetus for a mission, quote unquote. But in this case, and in general case, I think the more mundane and prosaic the mission is, the better. Although Dave's retreats notwithstanding, I mean, they're obviously not prosaic, they're kind of mysterious. But in terms of renovations and farming and goats and stuff, hopefully we'll get something moving there that will have an interest and appeal that will provide a context for you or others to just come and meet and hang out, besides meeting and hanging out, because, you know, we might run out of things to talk about pretty quick.
Well, I would want to, you know, hopefully bring something to the table as well, you know. Have you been doing any research into, you know, like farming and things like that, or do you already know quite a bit?
I definitely don't know quite a bit. Right after I mentioned rearing goats, somebody donated a book on how to raise goats to the thrift store, so I now have that book. Of course, I haven't read it. I haven't done any preparation in this regard, and I was saying to Samuel yesterday, it concerns me slightly because I just wonder if I'm being naive and thinking that I'll just be able to adapt to a whole new way of life when right now I'm just continuing with all my usual things, you know, while at the same time thinking that this is going to be a wonderful new life for me. I'm just trusting, you know, that the environment itself will inspire me to learn what I need to learn. How hard can it be? I mean, this is it's not like we have to do it overnight, you know.
Right.
We're not going to start with some land and say, okay, nobody gets to eat anything until we have our first crop.
Yeah. And you'll probably come across plenty of resources and knowledgeable people, and they'll be put, you know, in your path, and and there'll be a learning curve, but it'll probably be an enjoyable learning curve, I would imagine, you know.
I hope so. I mean, it may be steep or it may not. I think to some extent we can determine, possibly. And I mean, if we were doing this 10 years ago, it would have been very different. We'd have been less motivated too. As it is, well, I don't know actually how to finish that sentence, really. Just there's definitely more incentive to become self-sufficient or independent, or to at least minimize the amount of visits to society that are necessary, because of society has become so unwelcoming of late.
Yeah.
You know, all these faceless people pointing their finger at
you. Yeah.
All our sweetest sins, carry them till our ends, they made you. They made me. They say the dark will grow in my eyes across our skies and roll. Yeah, roll.
hidden under Papa's bed. The pistol my brother pressed to my head, singing, just trust in me. 'Cause this holy house is a home. The dead don't rest, they rise at our chest and our sin. Live on a tone.
Shoulder, so you're moving it around there. It's the right one.
Yeah. It gets rotator cuff, gets stiff and cracky, but
yeah.
It's okay for the most part, yeah. It's all those old guy injuries.
Do what?
Old guy injuries, the ones that just kind of, they just stay now, you know?
Right. I was having problems with my hips last night. Sometimes I do when I'm sleeping. My hips start aching, you know, on both sides, because I was flipped from one side to the other, and it worries me, because I think, God, if my hips are hurting now, what are they going to be like when I'm 80? But I don't know, it's not necessarily true. I mean, some of these symptoms may not only relate to aging. I don't even know, you know. I saw you moving your head around a lot as well. When Dave was talking about your throat and this constriction, he even talked about the slave collar. Did you know what he was talking about? Did you feel that that was customized to you?
Yeah, I felt like I knew what he was talking about, and I, you know, to me, I always related to like the throat chakra and communication, and I, you know, I do like often feel like a blockage in here, and it's not necessarily just verbal communication, although it does, you know, express itself that way sometimes. But that's what I took it to mean, what he was saying. I don't know if that's what he was saying or not, but
yeah. Right, well, and that's come up in our conversations, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The throat. But he was also talking physiologically in terms of constriction.
Right.
So do you feel that? When he was talking about that? Something about...
My posture and stuff like that. Yeah, I feel like I get really tight, you know. So yeah, I could feel that, and it's like sometimes, you know, when I'm even talking to you, I get that, you know, I start to get kind of shrinky, you know, like and feel a little bit tight, and yeah, I experience that so much less when I'm with somebody in person. You know, it's sometimes I wonder how much the layer of technology has to do with it. You know, it's sitting here like looking at a screen and trying to communicate with somebody that way. Although I'm sure it's possible to be completely relaxed doing that as well. So maybe it's just more of a symptom type of thing. You know, like if I can't be, you know, completely relaxed talking to somebody through a screen, then there's still work to be done or something like that, you know.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about whether you have discomfort being seen. It would be kind of normal, but so I'm sure you do. Mm-hmm. But around that, the discomfort being seen, and if because you're a big guy, right? I mean, I can see you're a muscular guy. How tall are you?
I'm 6 feet.
Right, so not huge, but still a big guy, right? So I was wondering that, like, if you feel a little uncomfortable being a big guy, and a part of it is you're trying to make yourself smaller.
I feel pretty awkward in my body a lot of times. And I do, I don't want to appear imposing, you know? So I do, and I'm, you know, with, I'm aware with the tattoos and everything like that, that it can look like that. But I, you know, I want to be approachable, and I want to, you know, so I do feel like sometimes I will shrink a little bit, and, you know, try and appear a little bit softer. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I like being in the water so much too, is because it's like I feel more, just more comfortable, and less, and I don't feel my body as much, you know.
You don't feel you. Oh, you mean you don't feel self-conscious
The
about
weight of it.
other weight?
Yeah.
Oh, so
Yeah.
you feel your body is heavy.
Sometimes, yeah.
That's funny, because that's been my compensation mentally for being so skinny, because I don't like being skinny in terms of how it looks, particularly. But I remind myself that being very light is something I'm glad of.
Oh.
Pretty light on my feet.
I am too, and I like when I feel light. It's most of the feeling heavy comes in, like just being seen. You know what I mean? Not like actually feeling heavy, like a weight issue or something like that, but just, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought initially you meant.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
I was. Well, so the tattoos are interesting, because it's like it's sending mixed messages. I mean, the tattoo, you could say, is a way to conceal yourself in a certain way, because you're putting a picture, or you're overlaying on top of yourself an image, literally. But it's also a way to attract attention. So you've
Look at me, don't look
got
at me.
dazed attention, yeah. And in terms of being imposing, as you've inferred, actually having body tattoos and even skulls and whatnot is obviously going to make you more imposing, right? So part of you does want to be imposing, and another part is then trying to compensate for that part by making yourself smaller or less intimidating.
Yeah, and it's, you know, being the permanent nature of tattoos also, it's like as I've gone through life, I'd say I probably wanted to become less imposing, you know, than maybe there was a time when I wanted to be a little bit more imposing.
When did you
And
get the that skull tattoo on your left arm, the wrist?
probably about 8 years ago.
Well, I was thinking that might have been an earlier one. So, what's your oldest tattoo then?
These birds here,
Yeah.
that was
What's well, so those are.
probably about 15 years ago, something like that. I didn't start getting tattooed till pretty late in life,
Right.
you know, considering.
Like 30s.
Early 30s. Yeah. But there was a whole period of time before that when I probably would have gotten tattooed and wanted to get tattooed, but was not really in any position financially, or, you know, just there was very few things I could show up for at that point in my life, you know,
Right.
struggling with addiction and whatnot. So, yeah.
You couldn't even commit to an hour tattoo session, you mean?
No, if I had enough money to spend on a tattoo, I wasn't spending it on a tattoo, you
Right.
know. And also, yeah, just I would probably wouldn't have shown up, and it was, the whole thing was still pretty mysterious to me at that point in time. I knew a lot of people that had tattoos, and I thought they were cool, and I liked them and stuff like that, but I just didn't think, you know, it was really for me, you know. I had gone into tattoo shops before and just kind of talked to the people and just felt, you know, pretty uncomfortable. Just kind of wanted to get out of there. But that has a lot to do with, you know, I couldn't really even look anybody in the eye very well at that point in time. So.
Hmm. What does your dad think of your tattoos?
He's fine with it. There was a time when I was younger when he was like, "Don't ever get tattoos," and you know, he was very,
he said
very
that
anti.
Before you decided to.
Before, yeah.
Right. So he just had. Why would he even say that though?
I had expressed, you know, interest or, you know, liked them or. Asked him about it or something like that. He would maybe point out somebody that had them, and you know, I can't remember specifically, but I just knew that it wasn't something that he was
right. I think that was
just associated with the whole criminal gangster thing and stuff like that. And,
right. Does that happen in Mexico as well? I mean, now that you're in Mexico, is that the people? You wouldn't get mistaken for a Mexican, but would you get Mm-mm. mistaken for a gringo cartel member?
I mean, maybe some people, but they wouldn't. You know, I've never had anybody like express that to me. You know,
yeah.
Common now. Yeah. You know, and a lot of people just like them, and it's a conversation starter a lot of times, and you know, people ask me about them, and then I tell them that that's, you know, that's what I do for a living, and then I end up, you know, making new connections and stuff that way. But back to my dad, the thing was that once I actually got them, you know, he was really upset at first, and then he ended up just, you know, now he's like, he sends me, you know, like articles about it, and I think when he saw that it was something that I was able to do for to support myself, and that, you know, began to see like the art in it, and appreciate it a little more, you know. So I was pretty much fully supportive
now. But
yeah,
do you think that I guess this is, can't avoid this question because of my psychological bent, but was that part of your motivation for getting them, do you think, that it would piss him off?
I don't think so, because if that was the case, I probably would have done it a lot sooner.
I thought you were busy getting drunk during that period, which was also pissing him off, presumably.
Well, that's what I was going to say, was that I think that probably pissed him off a lot more, and probably, you know, I had set the bar so low by that point in time that when I actually got the tattoos, it was like I think he was just
right.
Kind of happy that I had made it through all that shit and was still alive, so he couldn't really say much about the tattoos, you know, at that point. I mean, he could, but put him through so much other crap that.
Well, and I'm aware we're not in a one-to-one, and also we're kind of winding up in the podcast and stuff. But I'm starting to. I'm just wondering if all these things are slightly connected, like your self-image, your resistance to your dad, or not wanting to become like your dad, your alcoholism, your tattoos, your constriction. And that's intuition I had about your father. I mean, maybe it wasn't an intuition, maybe it's just a memory, because I know we've talked about him a lot, and his health is not good, right?
Well, he did have a stroke while I was in Mexico, and it was pretty serious. He was in the hospital for a while. Well, that was crazy in itself with all the stuff that's going on, because, you know, he was able to really see him or, you know, visit, or it was kind of hard to find out what was going on. Fortunately, he made it out of the hospital. He's
alive.
Yeah, exactly. He's able to use a walker a little bit. He's in a wheelchair and just kind of, you know, struggling with being able to just accept not being able to move around like he used to. And he's just got to do a lot of stuff, and even, you know, in his 80s, well, he's just 80 now, but the first year of being 80, he was still, you know, doing all kinds of climbing ladders and doing work and stuff like that. And so
right.
Yeah, he's dealing with that now, and I think a little bit depressed. But
does he need help, physical help?
Yeah, I've been helping him. That was one of the reasons I came back, was to try and help out.
And that would be a reason that you might stay longer as well.
Yeah, possibly. But I actually, my plan is just to come back and forth more frequently. So instead of going to Mexico and staying for like 7 months at a time, I would maybe come back every couple months for a week or so. It's so easy to fly there from here. It's only like a 2-hour flight.
Well, now it is, yeah. But that is something could change, isn't it?
Right, that could change, exactly. And I'm just kind of like going under the hope that it won't. But if it does change, I don't know, then I'd have to make a decision whether I want to be there or here. And I would probably opt for here, because if things really start hitting the fan, as far as, you know, people not being able to, you know, struggling to survive or feed themselves, I think I would rather be here.
Because of your father or other things?
Because of mostly just being stuck down there. I wouldn't want to be, you know, stuck down there. And especially, you know, like if things got desperate, I think they would get desperate there quicker, possibly. I mean, it could go either way, but
you'd be choosing between a cartel-run Mexico and a police state, right, in the U.S.
Right, right, which isn't much of a, isn't much of a choice. But I mean, part of the main reason that I'm there is because I love the freedom, and I love the ocean and the warm water and beautiful beaches. And, you know, having already had a taste of that being taken away the last time I was there, it wasn't such a paradise anymore,
right?
You know, and especially once the, you know, military started rolling through the streets with you know, telling everybody to stay in their house, and, you know, just roads being blocked off by big dirt piles and all that. I sent you that picture. It's wild. But yeah, so I don't know. I just see what happens. But as of right now, everything's kind of opened back up down there, and things are okay. So,
well, it seems like you've got the luxury of choice anyway. Currently, not exactly great choices, but I mean, at least you can come and go and.
Yeah,
and you can stay there with your father.
Yeah,
as long as you want.
Yeah, but both my parents, you know, they're both still alive, and they're both, you know, pretty, you know, they're happy for me being there as well, you know. So, yeah.
Well, somehow, I mean, I may be completely wrong, but somehow I got the sense that you don't really know where you want to be.
That's accurate. Yeah, I don't. I
don't mean geographically. I do mean that, but I also mean, I guess another way of putting it is that there's nothing that you feel really passionate about doing or being currently.
Yeah.
What's the sense? Yeah.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Which seems, I guess it's not odd. I mean, because it's the history of alcoholism that you've had. I mean, I forget that when I talk to you. Because you have a, I guess Dave, whatever Dave tuned into, he seemed to see you as somebody who was at risk, possibly in distress, and because, you know, when we talk, we do talk about, you know, stuff that you're having trouble mm-hmm. with. So it's not as though I don't see that and I'm not aware of that. But in a general way, you come across as somebody who's quite rooted and quite sorted and not sure of yourself. You don't seem sure of yourself at all. So maybe that's the tell. So what am I trying to say? I guess I'm trying to see myself in you, or mirror. And like, one thing I've always had is a real sense of purpose. And I guess I'm wondering if you don't have that, if you're still looking for that.
I feel like I've always kind of, it may be a oxymoron or whatever, but like stumbled across my purpose. Mm-hmm. Like things just, my the way my life has unfolded and the opportunities that I've come across, for like, you know, work and living, and they seem to just kind of fall in my path, and I've been pretty lucky that way, and I really like that way of being, you know. It's like I've become so used to that, get kind of going with the flow kind of thing, you know, that I think sometimes it does almost make me hesitant to develop a solid plan and try and pursue it.
Sure.
For fear of losing that.
But that, I wouldn't say that that's synonymous with purpose at all.
Yeah.
Like having a plan and sticking to it. More of a sense of the life force, just, yes, I know where to go. I shouldn't say I've always felt it. I've definitely had periods where I was really lost. And in a sense, I've always felt lost as well. But in terms of having a passionate sense of wanting to get somewhere, and in many cases erroneously feeling like I know where I'm going and what I want, I feel like I've consistently had that experience, and yeah, with you I'm just getting the sense we're talking now that maybe that you're still waiting for some impetus or inspiration.
I may be, but I don't feel like I'm waiting. You know, most of the time I feel pretty content, and I don't feel like something's sorely lacking, you know. But it would be interesting to see what it was like to feel that, you know, that drive or that, you know, specific purpose. I think we've talked about it like a little bit before, you know, my being in recovery and helping other people who are newer.
Right, you know, right.
It's a pretty
yeah. And we talked about whether your tattoo work wasn't a sort of placekeeper for something else, as in it provides you the opportunity to put your hands on people and help them kind of find some meaning in the literally superficial sense. And I think the word healing came up, didn't it? But being providing some sort of service for others. So yeah, perhaps the two things perhaps would be related.
Well, that's what it feels like a lot of times, and you know, it wasn't something that I was ever trying to get into either, you know. So it was kind of interesting, expecting it to be one thing and having it be another, you know. Like thinking, oh, you know, tattooing, it's going to be all about, you know, being an artist and, you know, producing these things and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But when I focus on that part of it, it's not nearly as, I don't get as much out of it. It's not so, it doesn't feel as fulfilling.
Mm. It's like me and writing.
Interactions. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're not looking to reach a huge audience and to be, you know, well known and,
well, I have been. I have been, but I've, you know, not been able to see that, and I've become more and more aware that it's really not where the satisfaction is, nor with the kind of pride in the product. Like 16 maps of hell, it's being printed now. Pretty much, I've got a proof and stuff, and I'm looking forward to reading it over as a book, which I've always done in the past, but. I'm aware that if I wait until people have their own copies, then I'll enjoy reading it back more, because it'll be a way to feel connected to the people that have it now, and I'll be kind of reading it through your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I mean, you could say there's some vanity and still in that for sure, but there's also, that is an actual connection. We're reading the same words, possibly at the same time, and that's the purpose of the writing, is to have some kind of something to send out there, a message in a bottle that will let others know where I'm situated and how to find me. That's the real meaning. And this is very central to Dave's project, or his mission, as far as helping others to find out who they are. What's the gift that you or I really have to deliver to others that I still feel I certainly haven't fully found it, I haven't fully located it, and I certainly haven't fully delivered it. It's not in the writing per se. The writing can be a means to that, or to a way to, you know, sow the ground so that whatever that is can flower in.
Mm.
But yeah, I still feel as though in my 50s I haven't quite found or delivered what it is in me that I have to deliver.
I feel like even if I figured out what it was, it would be just kind of a trick to get me to do, to get me to, like, whatever I think it is, it's probably not going to be what ends up being the result, or the, you know, like if there is a purpose, I'd have to be tricked into it. Like, I'd have to think that I'm doing this thing, you know, and, you know, because it feels good. It makes me think I'm somebody and doing something important, but then I would find out that it's actually about something else, you know, which is something that wouldn't necessarily appeal to me right off the bat, because it might not have all the,
like me and the thrift store.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I relate to that. I think that optimally, I mean, short of enlightenment, or on the way to enlightenment, we at least start to have the experience of knowing it when we're delivering it, even if we don't, we're not allowed to have the prior awareness. Oh, I'm going to do this now and feel good about it. We know as we're delivering it, and then we do start to discover, okay, so what I have to give is different. I mean, like you with the tattoo, you've been gradually discovering that you're giving something without being aware of giving it, but you notice when it's received.
Yeah.
Because you see the results. People light up in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, and the connections that, you know, with another soul, with another person, seems to be the thing that is really of value, and that people are attracted to. You know?
What they're seeking, even.
They're seeking, yeah.
Yeah, and seeking it while at the same time pushing it away, because it doesn't feel safe. So a big part of it is creating the right environment and circumstances in which we'll be open to receive and transmit, and others will be open to receive what we're transmitting. And yeah, I mean, the connection happens, and maybe we can notice it a little bit, but not so much that we panic, you know, and start to back away.
Right. Our responsibility. Yeah.
Well, an exposure to the sphere of being seen, as I said, that's universal. So like a full connection means being fully seen, like 360 degrees, like how God sees us. That's how our souls, I think that's how our souls perceive one another. And maybe even are the eyes of God.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
That's the end of my conversation with Jeff Gentry. 16 Maps of Hell. The paperback has been sent out to all those who've ordered it, I hope. If you're outside North America, that's 4 to 12 weeks time to arrive. If you're in the US or Canada, should be with you within a week from now, if it isn't with you already. So if you did order it and you're in that area, and you if you don't receive it a week from now, then let me know, because it's possible that you slipped through the net. It's been quite a task in terms of admin. The audiobook is also available. It's £20. You can order it online, as well as hardback and paperback still available. If you paid for option 3 for the paperback in the fundraiser before May 24th, you're also eligible for the audiobook, which you should have received already, but again, you could have slipped through the net. So if you qualify there and you didn't get the audiobook, send me a line. Nature is lost, we don't belong. Streams are filled, cement is poured, we're all just bored. Stuck inside, this life moves fast, we'll drink the to deep sleep.